you probably know, if you're paying attention, that once again, this week, we are reminded as a nation that systemic racism and violence is still happening. If, in case you forgot. And in a way, the forgetting is a little bit what I want to talk about tonight. There's a teaching in the early Buddhist system that talks about what the usual translation is realms or kind of abidings, places one could get reborn. This is a teaching called the teaching of the six realms. And this is a teaching that you can interpret literally as a kind of literal mythology or cosmology, that there are, you know, like parallel dimensions or universes in which various kinds of beings exist. This would be a very traditional, one kind of a traditional interpretation. But there are other interpretations, not just modern, but very ancient, to interpret these realms also, or instead, as aspects or ways of talking about psychology or direct human experience. And then there are some hints in this direction. The most pleasurable, or you could say highest, but let's just say most pleasurable of the realms are called heaven realms, the realms where beings live who are described as being extremely beautiful and healthy and who experience a lot of pleasure and bliss, who are extremely long-lived, but who aren't, you know, God in the kind of the Western sense. Like, they're not immortal, they're not perfect, they are mortal, flawed beings like us. They just happen to be having a very good time for a very long time until they die from that realm, same as we die from this realm. And based on their actions, their karma, their accumulated momentum as ethical beings, they get reborn somewhere else, right? Either in another heaven realm or in another realm, a realm of humans or animals or one of the more difficult realms, hell realms, etc. But one of the hints in the early texts that this is not just a fanciful kind of pre-modern cosmology is that several of the heaven realms, there's many of them, some are more subtle, some are more gross, several of them correspond exactly to the deep meditative states that we can attain in ordinary meditation or quite refined meditation, but we can attain these states as human beings. States where there's incredible pleasure in the body, or incredible stillness in the mind, or a perception that's so refined that all we perceive is consciousness extending infinitely out in all directions. These are states that are accessible to some people. It really depends on your nervous system, trauma, training, basic skill. Some of us have an easier time concentrating than others. But they're simply states that can be cultivated. But they are also heaven realms. And so then there's a sense that the heaven realms are not just a literal idea of some distant realm, but there's something that you can live in now. And so then, if we take up this idea that the six realms is a way of describing states of being that any of us could be in, and that we can be in any of the six realms, and that we can move between them, that we do move between them in the course of a human life, then we have a map for understanding or framing some of the most potent experiences that we have as humans. So here's what the six realms are. Starting with the most pleasurable, there are heaven realms. The heaven realms are characterized, as I said, by profoundly easeful experience. The second of the realms is also very pleasurable. This is a realm called sometimes called the jealous gods, which I like a lot. These are beings who are also like the gods in the heaven realms, long-lived, healthy, we could say, you know, quite privileged, right? They have access to a lot of pleasures, but they're not just resting in deep ease. There's a wanting for more. There's a wanting to be more like the gods, or to be higher up on the ladder of subtle pleasures. So they're still like the heaven realms, except that there's a little more dissatisfaction in them, right? There's a little more hunger for, the grass is a little bit greener in these realms, even though the grass is quite green still for these folks, the jealous gods, they're called. And then there's the human realm, which we think we're familiar with. In the Six Realms theory, there's the idea that the human realm, I'll put it in quotation marks, since we as beings can experience any of these states, the human realm is a state of some degree of balance, where there's contact with some pleasures and contact with pain and suffering. And the classical idea about the human realm is that the balance is such that we don't get deluded by pleasure, nor are we so lost in the torment of pain that we can't have some clarity in the mind or heart. And so the human realm is considered the ideal state in which to practice the Dharma, or to do yogic practices with the intent of liberation, because we have the most chance of seeing clearly. Up in the God realms, you would think, oh, I could meditate all day long, and you could. But the proposal here is that when there's so much pleasure or ease, or we could even say, to use the trauma language, safety happening, it's quite easy to be really deluded, to just be like, oh, everything's fine, and to not really look closely at suffering. In other words, not to look at the other realms, even though you could see them if you turned your gaze in that direction. Why would you? The party is raging, right? Even though out on the street, things are really different. So the God realms have a kind of delusion to them. We don't look past a certain veil. So the human realm is said to be a place where we can see in both directions, and that's what's needed for liberation. Then there's three realms that are called in some of the texts the lower realms, being a sort of egalitarian socialist. I don't love the lower terminology, but they are realms where discomfort is predominant. The first of those is the animal realm. And I actually, just to really be bold in relation to this ancient teaching, I a little bit think of like the heaven realms, the jealous gods, and the human realm, and then kind of parallel to the human realm is the animal realm. And then there's the more suffering realms, partly because it's clear that in both the human and the animal realms, first of all, I have a kind of post-Darwinian attitude that says that we are actually animals, so there's not really a difference between those realms. We seem to do some things that most animals don't, like destroy the planet. So who knows, we could flip-flop them in terms of which one is actually better. But the animal realm traditionally is characterized by not even so much discomfort, but the mind-heart state of habitualness or instinct, which has a kind of dullness to it. It also has a kind of liveliness to it. It's quite pure, but it's quite repetitive. And so the sense was like, oh, we don't see the animals, you know, like making art or you know, kind of going outside of a certain realm of activities very much. And this might be this is up for debate. You know, especially if you, you know, have been paying attention to, like, you know, the dolphins and other relatively, as far as we can tell, quite intelligent animals out there. But we could say that within the realm of animals, which includes very high up animals like dolphins, and then you know, mosquitoes and cockroaches and various rude creatures that bite and don't seem very interesting to us anyway. Who knows? There's a realm of animals that has a kind of repetitiveness to it, a kind of dullness to it. The next realm down is a realm that, Or actually, let me skip the next realm and go all the way to the bottom, to the hell realms. The hell realms are parallel to the heaven realms in that if the heaven realms are characterized by endless ease and pleasure and privilege, the hell realms are characterized essentially by endless torment, distress, pain. These are the realms where hatred and fear, torture of various kinds are the predominant experience. And again, like the heaven realms, they're not permanent. They're very painful. And it's hard to see outside of them, right? There's also a kind of delusion in them. When pain or torment is so intense, it's very difficult to see the possibility of something else. And so we might have access, we might have experience with these realms. These realms tend to be quite traumatic, right? They leave a lasting mark on the spirit for some time. But again, they're not permanent. So then, like the heaven realm is bordered by the jealous gods realm, which is also quite pleasant, but contains a yearning for more godliness, the hell realm is bordered by a realm that's called quite poetically the realm of the hungry ghosts. And the hungry ghosts are beings that are quite tormented. They're kind of starving and hurting, but they have an appetite for nutriment. Unfortunately, their appetite is vast and it can never be satisfied. The old kind of pictures, the images of the beings in these realms are of beings with huge bellies and tiny pinhole mouths. So it's an old hell realm image, right? Like in a Bosch painting or something, where they just can't get enough nutrition. They can't get enough to satisfy. So there's always this like aching hunger or a yearning for a little more safety or well-being. So here's a map then that says, and now I'll just go completely psychological on it or sociological on it, that as beings we can spend periods of our lives, even or entire lives, predominantly in one of these realms, or we could move around a lot. And if we look around our world, we can see, if we're paying attention to other people, beings in all of these realms. You know, as I walk from my house down into my neighborhood, Temescal, a nicely or annoyingly groovy neighborhood, I can see beings in all of these realms, right? I can see beautiful young people on beautiful bicycles gliding down the street, apparently coursing in extraordinary pleasure, the pleasure of just being them, and not seeming to notice anything else other than the awesomeness of being themselves. Right? I can say, oh, these are beings in a heaven realm right now. And one of the wonderful things about this map of the six realms is there's no blame in it. It's really, you know, a being's karma landed them in those realms. It's considered to be a good fortune to land in a heaven realm, but it's not liberation yet. So I see beings in heaven realms. Often, if I dig in, I find that many of the beings that I think are in heaven realms are actually in jealous god realms. When I think about myself, generally, I think, oh, I spend a lot of time kind of in the jealous gods realm. By which I understand that I have a tremendous amount of privilege. And now I'll start using that word that is now charged with meaning in the social justice conversation. I have quite a bit of privilege. I get white privilege in this culture, even though I'm not completely white, whatever that means. I'm Puerto Rican and sort of Puerto Rican German English, something like that. So if you put me in a room with a lot of people who with like Irish, English, Scandinavian heritage, I'm clearly brown. But as I was growing up, no one said, hey, you're brown. So I got white label. So I get white privilege. I get male privilege. I get straight privilege, partly because I'm married to a woman. No one really knows that I like guys too, so I don't get much oppression for being bi. So I get that privilege as well. I get education privilege. I'm highly educated. I get religious privilege in a certain way, in the way that priests or folks who have focused on spiritual practice often have a kind of social standing that's as high as even like the wealthy. Right, I have students that are extremely wealthy and powerful, and who respect me because I have this other standing. So that's also a privilege. And this whole, all these layers of privilege. But I, so sometimes if I let my, if I forget that those are privileges and I just let myself wash in the wonderfulness of my life, you know, if I just kind of float around the hot pool at Harbin when it existed, and I don't think about how lucky I am, I drift over to the God realms, right? Oh, me and my friends, we can just listen to good music and eat good food and nothing's wrong, right? But then I look around and I see, oh wait, some people are actually having a better time than me, right? Some of the pretty people are prettier, happier, richer, etc. And then I find that I've shifted into the jealous God's realm. Things are great, but I want more. I want, you know, more affection, more money, more adventure, whatever. So I see the jealous gods, a lot of jealous gods in our little metropolis here. It's sort of the primary state that's visible on a certain level. I'll skip the human realm for now. Certainly there's humans all over the place. I think the humans are actually the ones that seem wisest, the ones that seem clearest in a certain way, like that have some perspective about where we are. Certainly I see people doing the habitual activities we could associate with the description of the animal realm, right? Just the day in, day out, right? Pull up to the drive-thru espresso place, drive to the thing, do the thing, drive back, da-da-da, just kind of churning through habitual activity, right? And of course, in my neighborhood, because there's still quite intense poverty and homelessness, I see the hungry ghosts, and they're out on the streets, and they're raving in a monologue about something, or they're asking for sustenance with a cup out or a sign, and you can tell that there's a need there that is very hard to meet. There's so much poverty and so little, in a certain way, generosity in this culture. And then I see, you know, the beings who are truly in, it seems like, kind of hell realms, where you just see those that are in a kind of torment, whether internally or physically, whether psychologically or physically. And so we have a culture that has beings experiencing all of these very different ways of existing superimposed. Some of my neighbors are quite a bit more wealthy than I. Some of my neighbors are quite a bit less wealthy than I. And there's we're all there together on West Street. How this relates a bit to what's happening now, as we're being shown again and again that systemic racism is a constant right now, has been for a very long time. Now that we have video cameras, we see as a nation specific acts of violence that in earlier eras were intimately known more just by the communities that they affected directly. So African-American communities always knew that the police were not a safe protector. But now many in the heaven realms, we would say, are being exposed to a reality of this country that is deeply troubling. And I think this is basically a very good thing. The fact that it's happening is horrid, terrible, and very difficult to bear. I think the fact that it's more and more visible is good. And part of how I understand this from a Dharma perspective is that beings, especially middle and upper class white folks, straight, white, privileged folks who have enjoyed some decades of relatively extreme power and comfort and ease in this country, are going through a period of being pulled out of, or we could even say mythologically dying out of, the heaven realms and landing in the human realm, in many cases unwillingly, and some cases very willingly. Right? Among some of my white friends, there's an urge right now to learn more, to do undoing white racism courses, to learn what whiteness is, to re-identify with our direct heritage rather than assuming the normative label white, as a way to try to unbind the tangle that this systemic ideology manifests in us. And so I'm beginning to feel like it's actually a responsibility in this kind of second wave or next wave of the civil rights struggle for folks of various kinds of privilege. So that could be racial privilege if you feel like you receive white privilege, or if you don't feel like you do, but you do. It's good to recognize. That can be class privilege if you come from an owning class or middle class background, even if that class has shifted. Like, I'm not hardly as financially secure as my parents were, but I still bear the privilege of having grown up middle class. I have a middle class education, even though I have no retirement and only just got health care at the age of 42. I still have received the benefits of that. Whatever way that privilege manifests for us, part of, I think, the responsibility of the gods and the jealous gods is to awaken within the realms of privilege and actually, in a way, to willingly die out of those realms into the human realm. In other words, to renounce the delusion of constant access to ease and move toward contact with that which is true for many, many, most people on this planet, which is the reality of aspects of distress and suffering. This recognition enfolds into the Dharma teaching on karma. Karma, I'm not going to go deeply into, but we touch on it many times in this group. Karma, very simply, is the understanding in the early yogic traditions that actions all bear fruit, that our choices and actions all bear fruit in some ways, and that the choices and actions of all those that have come before continue to bear fruit. Essentially, law of thermodynamics, right? Energy going in one direction tends to continue in that direction, even as it contacts other bodies, spreads through the ecosystem. Momentum is another word for karma. So as we orient toward this, we can say, oh, this word that's useful right now as we try to wake up, this word privilege, is one of the useful definitions of it right now is anything pleasurable or good, anything that we like, that is unearned, anything unearned in our system. So this goes against some of the ideologies that some in this country really like, that those who are doing well earned that well-being as individuals. You know, like, I did all the work to make myself awesome, when actually I know that, you know, I didn't. Whether or not I'm awesome, I didn't do the work to make myself that. I was given so much, right? Because I was raised in a safe, comfortable, boring, but comfortable California suburb, in a program called The Gifted and Talented, whatever that meant. What it meant was I got pulled out of school slightly early on some afternoons to go and learn Shakespeare and to put on a Shakespeare play or to do some other sort of gifted-y thing. Mostly it meant that me and the other nerds got to be nerds together. Great. But I didn't earn that, right? That was just, it was just part of the milieu that I grew up in. And so beginning to reckon with privilege is a way of saying, can I turn my analytical lens or my passionate inquiry lens toward those aspects of karma that are bearing fruit in me that I did not initiate? Aspects of karma that are bearing fruit in my experience that I did not initiate. So I'm experiencing the fruit, for instance, of, let's say, I'm experiencing the fruit of the history of the dynamic between European settlers and native people in this country. And one of those fruits is that I live on stolen land, for instance, to shift lenses for a minute from race to our relationship to the indigenous. And to the extent that I don't think about that, I am continuing in the delusion of the God realms. To the extent that I willingly address that, and I say, oh, this is a privilege that was unearned and actually came with some degree of harm, can I recognize that and reckon with that and be undiluted about that? To the extent that I can do that, I have the possibility of entering into my humanity with that truth and then living in a different way, actually resolving that karma in a different way. There's an Ohlone organization in the East Bay that that is asking each of us who lives here to pay them a tax, basically a renter's tax, for living on their land for the last 600 years. And they have a clean and good way to calculate that depending on your income and where you live and whatnot. And it's worth doing as a way to say, I insist on being undiluted about the history of this place. And that's just one example. There are so many, right? How do we wake up to the layers of karma that are present in our lives and willingly renounce the delusion of the heaven realms in whatever way that we may or may not live in them? If you don't live in them, then you don't have to renounce it, right? If you're not privileged in that way. I don't know the individual stories of each of us. But for those who find themselves living in the God realms and the jealous God realms, I begin to think that one of the clearest things we can do as Dharma practitioners is to admit that and turn aside from the hypnotic nature of the pleasures that the ease that this culture can offer us if we keep our blinders on and open to what's happening for others. So I'll pause there. Thanks for listening. And now we just shift into open conversation. Stories from your experience, questions, anything this direction of inquiry brings up for you. And the floor is open.
Say what comes up for me?
Please do.
Well, just that, I don't claim to understand anything about anything, what seems to matter to me is that how can we dissolve the karma as quickly as possible?
Yeah.
And how do we decrease the sense of separation, and feeling like this separate identity from others.
Yeah.
And increase and enhance this sense of we're the same.
Yeah.
And we all belong and we're all deserving of the fruits of life.
Yeah.
Equally.
Yeah.
And so and what comes up for me, and this just seems to be a kind of theme that has come up for me a little bit lately, is forgiveness.
Mm.
And so that's just something I'm kind of personally exploring and playing with a little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just touching into it.
Yeah.
So how that speaks to all of this, I'm not entirely sure, but that's kind of present for me.
Yeah. Forgiveness. Does your intuition orient toward a particular directionality of that forgiveness? Like, is it about forgiving others? Is it about forgiving myself? Is it about asking for forgiveness?
Mm-hmm. I guess it's what did you say, omnidirectional, it goes in every direction.
Yeah.
So within oneself and then socially as well, because with any harm,
yeah,
it affects all parties.
Yeah.
I mean, the person inflicting the harm, the person that the harm is being inflicted upon, somebody watching it happen,
yeah,
everybody's traumatized by the event. And so it's something that, and we realize that we do that in our unconsciousness. Something around that for me makes it easier to go, like, I didn't know, I was not awake or aware enough to know what was going on, but that person wasn't. And so it makes it easier to be in that loving and compassionate space, and that feels so much better.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Please.
Hi.
So it seemed like in my eyes, when I think of the God or the heaven realms, I think of it more like from a spiritual perspective, like I guess kind of like the enlightened ones, like, you know, mm-hmm. like experience pure happiness and joy and all those positive things.
Yes.
But it seemed like you related it more to like a material perspective, and you talked a lot about how that realm, there were delusions. And it seemed like you almost made the human realm seem more perfect. Why is that? I would expect the God realm to not be the delusional one.
Totally. That's a good question. This is very specifically a Buddhist orientation to the word God realm or heaven realms, which is that the Buddha really emphasized that if there was a realm of enlightened ones or perfected ones that was like a place you could end up, that by its nature, it would not be perfect. In other words, if it was a place among other places, it would be finite in a certain way. And so the only way for it to be perfect is for it to be not a realm. And so then the Buddha would say that the beings in the heaven realms are quite wonderful beings, often quite wise, very, very kind and loving, but not enlightened. And in the Buddhist definition, if we wanted to use that word, it's not really a Buddhist word, but if we wanted to use that word from the European Enlightenment, we would say enlightenment for the Buddhists means actually liberated from karma entirely, liberated from even the heaven realms. And so even godly beings, heaven realm beings, would come to the Buddha for teachings in the texts. And the reason that the emphasis is on the human realm as being, in a sense, the best is because in order to be liberated, we have to become very wise or clear-seeing in relation to suffering. We have to know why there is suffering and how to uproot it in ourselves. And the Buddha said the only place, the best place to see that clearly is in the human realm. Because when we're in any of the other realms, the almost like the emotional flavor of that realm is so strong that it's hard to see clearly. It's a little bit like saying, it's very difficult to have a conversation with someone very seriously about, like, you know, the difficulties in the world when they're like tripping on MDMA, right? Because they're going to be like, you're going to be like, oh my God, the war in Syria, it's so bad. And they might be like, it's okay. All we have to do is just love everybody and it's going to be okay. Are you okay? Right? And we could say that's somebody in a God realm moment, right? All they're perceiving is love. But there's a delusion there. Their perspective is colored. They're not actually able to see that it's not all love. You know, and like on a godly sense it is, but they're not actually in contact with reality. And so the human realm is in a sense, it's the most sober of the realms. And so it's the place where you can actually see clearly, oh, here's where I suffer, here's where I don't. And the Buddha called himself the one who was gone, the one who actually had stepped off of those realms entirely. So that's the Buddhist distinction, where the heaven realms are not actually perfect or enlightened. They're awesome, but to be liberated, so to get out of the cycle of just endlessly landing in these different places, you have to see clearly, and the pathway to seeing clearly, according to this tradition, is to do it from the kind of sober perspective of the human realm. Yeah?
That clears things up a lot. Thank you.
Awesome. And just to make it less clear, other traditions from the Indian system think about this completely differently, right? And of course, like, if we go Hindu, there's fully God realms where there are actual gods, Krishna and Vishnu and Shiva and Durga and Shakti and all those excellent beings who are, in fact, kind of infinite perfection, or Brahman, the infinite. And the Buddha avoided that characterization of, like, these infinitely perfect gods because he felt like relating with human insight as being the most transformative thing was actually a clearer pathway to liberation than relating to an external perfection. So, and then there was a long conversation about how those views kind of met each other over the course of, you know, a couple thousand years. So, long conversation. Thanks for asking. What else is here?
I'm curious about seeing clearly, and
me too.
How to do that? Just really, like, I want practical guidance with how to get clear when you're caught up, really absorbed in your own suffering, your own limited perspectives. And I feel like sometimes, tapping into what's going on in the world, and it's just even beyond what I'm capable of doing, like, to get a sense of how privileged I am in comparison, and how, when you're really stuck, how to just get your bearings.
Truly. Truly, it's overwhelming, right? And of course, now we have access to so much information that, you know, like over the last 2 days, the American media world was like, and the American sort of activist protest, you know, civil rights, Black Lives Matter world was like, you know, all eyes on Baton Rouge, and then we haven't even, like, the candles on the vigil haven't even burned down before something happens in Minnesota, right? And it's like, oh, and like suddenly, it's there's too much, right? There's too much. And then, so we're overwhelmed. It's difficult to get our bearings. Here's, you said, like, what's a really practical thing? Here's a kind of, here's a way of saying how we might practice with that. In any given moment, we could identify what external, I'll put that in quotation marks, what external situation or object I'm being aware of, and then I could identify what, I'll put it in quotations, internal state or emotion or reaction I'm experiencing. And if we simplify it down to just those two things, we can say, you know, I'm looking at a Facebook post about police brutality and I'm feeling overwhelmed. And if I just get really simple and I don't expand out to like, oh my God, and then there's the whole world of the infinite web of complexity. I'm just like, no, right now I'm looking at a Facebook post about brutality and I'm feeling overwhelmed or angry or sad or confused or whatever. That the process of sorting things out, about getting clear, can start with what over in kind of philosophy we would call like a phenomenological approach, meaning there's exactly what I'm perceiving and there's exactly the state that I'm experiencing. And can I name those? And the naming is really important. This is a huge part of like Vipassana practice. So in the example that I gave, I could be more specific. I could say, you know, I'm reading a heartbroken blog post by an African-American racial justice activist from the South who is giving her direct experience of this ongoing experience of her community being under attack. I'm reading this, and then as a privileged, mostly white Californian, I'm feeling these things. I'm feeling remorse, I'm feeling guilt, I'm feeling anger at the system. And I could say, I could focus on one of those. I say, oh, right now I feel just angry. And then I would ask, okay, what's anger like? And the process really is, can I feel what's happening in more detail? Right? Can I understand it better? What is anger? And I say, well, what is anger? It's like, oh, my body's kind of hot and my heart is beating. And I feel a little shut down. I feel like, I don't know what to do, right? And I would just be like, that's just true. So coming to clarity means, this is exactly what I'm perceiving. I'm reading exactly this blog post or whatever I'm looking at. And this is exactly what I'm feeling. And mostly it's going to turn out to be tracking what I'm feeling to get clear. Because I'm going to notice that like, I started to get angry, and then I instantly had the feeling that I couldn't do anything about it, and then I shut down. And so becoming clear is going to partly be getting really familiar with my exact patterns around how I respond to the world, right? And we're all going to have our tendencies, right? Some people are going to tend toward getting angry and loud. Some people are going to tend toward shutdown. Some people are going to tend toward, like, overwhelm. I can't deal. Whatever your flavor. And all of the flavors are just self-protective, right? They're our psyche kind of trying to be like, I can't deal with this. How do I stay safe? Like, well, I fight back. There's a rally down in downtown Oakland tonight. You could go down after we stop meeting. The process of becoming clear then is a kind of, you know, pause, observe, feel, kind of identify, name, and repeat, essentially. Make sense?
Does that process lessen the suffering? If you notice this is habitual, this is...
Yes and no. The process while you're in it tends to amplify the painfulness of the things that are already painful, but I'm not really looking at them because la, 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 I can't hear you, right? If I actually look at anger, it's going to hurt more than if I'm just like, yeah, 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 the world sucks, let's just watch Orange is the New Black, right? Like, I can be in denial, and that is more comfortable than being in contact with painfulness. So you can always say, let's go back into the God realm. Like, I can't deal with the street, let's go back into the party. So becoming more clear will tend to increase the intensity of the feeling as you come into contact with it. But over time, and this is in the beginning of our practice, we might have to take this on faith, but the Buddha promises this is true, and you can choose to believe him, or the great saints in this tradition, that say that when we see something for what it is, the fact that that seeing is accurate or true actually has a kind of pleasure to it, right? Which I think maybe you get, right? Like, it's painful to see the world as what it is, but it's actually, there's a certain rightness to it that feels good. And it feels good, and this is partly what draws us forward in the practice, it feels good in a way that being deluded to it, even though it might be in the moment less painful, actually doesn't feel very good. And that over time, the sense is that when we see it really clearly and we continue to develop our wholesome qualities, the suffering does decrease because the reactivity decreases. Right? Once you become friends with your anger, your fear, your shutdown, the way that they sting changes. You know, it lessens over time. And eventually, our state, our being shifts. You know, there's more love, there's more equanimity, there's more forgiveness present in the field as we practice. And the suffering changes. Right. And the Buddha promises, he says, if it were not possible to free the heart completely from distress and suffering, I would not tell you to do it. Only because it is possible to free the heart completely from distress and suffering do I suggest to you that you do it. So he says it's possible. Yeah. Yeah.
So is the observation and the seeing clearly, is that like the entire goal, kind of, is just the observation of the behavior as opposed to the shifting of the behavior?
Observation is a little bit the tool. And then, yeah, shifting is, in a sense, the next step. So I'm glad you're bringing it in. It's kind of like, we might get the sense from Western Vipassana or Western Buddhism, especially some forms of Zen and non-dual practice, that the only thing needed to do is just observe and do nothing. But actually, in the texts, there's lots of instructions about what to actively do. And the main thing to actively do is to substitute wholesome qualities for unwholesome ones. So for instance, if I find myself angry, the first thing to do is to know it and observe it and feel it. But then I could bring in a wholesome quality to support shifting my behavior. So for instance, I can practice pausing before I throw dishes. Good practice, right? And then I might practice recognizing the fire of defensiveness that might lead to throwing dishes, and I could practice, you know, any of the good qualities. I could practice love, I could practice compassion, I can practice patience, I can practice generosity. And the idea is that I substitute wholesome qualities for unwholesome ones over time by vowing to cultivate them. That's partly why taking the precepts is the foundation for everything. Right? So I say, for instance, say in relation to privilege, the second precept on not stealing can also be interpreted as not taking that which was not offered to me. Right? So then I could abstract that to be not taking the benefits of my privilege that I didn't actually earn. So then I can say, oh, I'm actually going to forego being, you know, being a part of gentrification, for instance. I have a friend who has the money to buy a house in a neighborhood that she wants, but she actually said, I'm not actually going to buy a house there because that would contribute to a process that's going on right now that I'm not in favor of. And she's going to use her resources elsewhere, even though she has the privilege to do this thing that she sees as unwholesome. So over time, first observing, we then replace the deluded or fearful qualities that motivate our actions in that direction with wholesome qualities, mostly their emotional, mental qualities, that would then motivate different actions. And that becomes just a vow over time to do that. And then bit by bit, not only do our actions change, but the reactive or really painful emotional seeds that were unwholesome also shift. because we keep replacing them with something else. Right. So it's a little bit sort of the action piece. Like, first observe, and then do it differently, basically. Right? And that we have choice to do that. And we actually have a responsibility in a way to do that. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, thanks for asking that piece. We'll talk more about kind of action steps in the near future. So we'll just short, we're at our time, but what do you want to toss something in? All right, next time. I'm making more of an effort to respect the bounds of time this season, so not to go too far over time. I always will stick around for a few moments if you want to just come up for more chatting or burning reflections. Thank you for your presence, your warmth, your kind listening. Welcome to new folks. The topic of discussion changes all the time. We weave between traditional teachings, social justice, other things. We weave between the Buddhist and yoga traditions as well. And we offer this group entirely within the quite ancient practice of the gift economy. So we would say fully on donation. And the invitation with that is that if you find yourself being someone with some resources, that you practice, in a sense, using the donation process as a way to voluntarily renounce a tiny bit of the privilege of the God realm you live in, if you have enough money to spare, and that doing so immediately translates into practices like this, spaces like this, being more open for folks in other realms. So thank you for your generosity. What you offer gets split in half between the studio and myself and goes in that basket on the shelf there. Thanks for folding blankets neatly and stacking them with the rounded edge out. And I'll see you very soon. Take good care.